Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, May 9th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "What does horseshoe contract termination mean?" Midland County leaders disagree on the impact of the vote Monday to terminate the deal with the horseshoe operator. By Ben Schaffer. County leaders discussed the county's decision to terminate the contract between Midland County and Horseshoe Hospitality. On Monday morning, County Judge Terry Johnson made the motion to terminate the horseshoe contract effective immediately. The vote passed 3-2, with Precinct 1 Commissioner Scott Ramsey and Precinct 2 Commissioner Jeff Somers opposing. Johnson said Monday's action from the court dissolves the need for services from Horseshoe Hospitality to Midland County. Ramsey said he does not believe the cancellation of the contract is valid. The Precinct 1 Commissioner sent the reporter telegram a portion of the contract labeled Funding Out Provision, which states, quote, "In the event that either no funds or insufficient funds are budgeted or appropriated for the payments due under this agreement, for a period covered by such a budget or appropriation, the agreement shall terminate without penalty to Midland County." Ramsey said, following the commissioner's court meeting, that there has been no discussion in court about defunding the contract for next year. Johnson said there is no language in the contract that prohibits Monday's action, and the commissioner's court has the ability to choose who deals with county assets. Ramsey and Somers also expressed concern regarding the status of Horseshoe employees and management. "We do this now, what does it look like tomorrow? Who's in charge? Who's managing that whole operation? Tomorrow? Next week? Next month?" Somers questioned during the meeting. Johnson said an interim manager will be hired to fill the void created by the contract termination. Ramsey countered, saying there is no one employed by Midland County who is qualified to run the facility. "The horseshoe requires professional management, not just some county employee from facilities," Ramsey added. Ramsey continued, saying from his perspective, the planning for Monday morning's action was non-existent, and he is uncertain about the future as it regards the horseshoe. The horseshoe complex includes the arena, education building, pavilion, and amphitheater. Multiple members of the current commissioner's court, including Johnson and Precinct 4 Commissioner Diane Anderson, used change at the horseshoe as part of their respective campaign messages during their elections. About a year ago, Johnson formed a citizens' committee to review the current horseshoe contract and bring their findings to the commissioner's court. The committee recommended the county terminate the contract as soon as practical during April 24th Commissioner's Court. In January, the Commissioner's Court voted to give Judge Johnson sole responsibility in dealing with horseshoe management, 4-1, with Ramsey opposing the motion. This article is entitled Affidavit, Fort Stockton Man Charged with Sexual Assault, by Mercedes Cordero. A 25-year-old Fort Stockton man was arrested Thursday for sexual assault, according to court documents. Austin Jake Hernandez was being held in Midland County Jail on Monday on a $100,000 bond for sexual assault, a second-degree felony charge, and a combined $3,500 for two Class A misdemeanors, driving while intoxicated, and criminal trespass. An officer with Odessa Police Department was dispatched Thursday at about 2:54 a.m. in reference to a sexual assault. The victim stated she had been sexually assaulted by someone named Austin. The assault occurred in Midland County. The victim stated she was asleep in her bed and was woken up by the assault. She stated she did not give consent or Austin permission to be in her apartment. She said he identified himself as Austin after she told him to leave her apartment, according to the arrest affidavit. The victim stated that Austin had left his property, which included size 11 shoes, a baseball cap, sunglasses, and a cell phone. Officers located Austin, who was later identified as Austin Jake Hernandez, outside of an apartment building inside of a running vehicle. The officer observed that Hernandez had slurred speech and had a strong odor of alcohol coming from his person, according to the arrest affidavit. The officer noted he was missing his shoes and asked what size he wore. Hernandez stated he wore size 11. He was also asked to describe his hat, sunglasses, and cell phone. The description he gave for his personal items matched those left behind in the victim's apartment, according to the arrest affidavit. The victim was able to confirm Hernandez was the person who sexually assaulted her, according to the arrest affidavit. Officers also conducted standard field sobriety. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, American Drivers Are Last Hope for Global Fuel Makers Ahead of Tenuous Travel Season, by Chunzi Zhu, Elizabeth Lowe, and Jack Whittles, Bloomberg. The global fuel-making industry is pinning its hopes for summer demand on American drivers. That's an iffy bet. Although U.S. gasoline usage appears to be exceeding year-ago levels as cheaper prices at the pump encourage households to hit the road, cracks have started to emerge in the world's biggest economy. Implied U.S. gasoline demand plunged nearly 900,000 barrels a day in the latest weekly report, the biggest drop this year. And the fast-approaching driving season isn't looking like one for the record books either. U.S. gasoline consumption will total 9.09 million barrels a day between June and August, according to government forecasts, up slightly year on year, but still down more than 6% from pre-pandemic rates. "We are not seeing the fireworks that summer typically brings," said Mukesh Sadev, head of the downstream practice at Rystad Energy. Why, then, do many international refiners see the U.S. gasoline market as their best chance to sop up supply? Because it's even worse in many other parts of the world. Gasoline consumption in major consumer Indonesia was below 2019 levels this month, and Southeast Asian nations are importing less of the fuel seasonally. At the same time, demand for diesel, the other major product churned out by refineries, has been slipping across the globe. Margins are already flashing signs of stress. In the U.S., the so-called crack spread, the difference between the price of finished products and the cost of crude, fell by more than 20% in the month of April. Margins have also weakened in Asia and Europe. If demand isn't sufficient to keep margins afloat, refiners that have enjoyed strong profits in recent years will consider cutting output. Further dampening the outlook is a batch of new supply coming online. About 2 million barrels a day of global refining capacity is expected to start this year, mostly in the Middle East and China. Even in the U.S., refiners are adding units for the first time in decades, after a period of rapid closures during the pandemic. That comes at a time when stockpiles of light distillates, such as gasoline, and naphtha at Asia's regional oil distribution hub of Singapore are now well above the seasonal average for the last 5 years. We are heading back to a period where global refining capacity will run in excess of global products demand and crude supply for a few years. Energy Aspects Limited analysts Amrita Sen and Christopher Haynes wrote in a recent note. To be sure, there are some glimmers of hope for global refining. In China, fuel makers have been boosting production to respond to better-than-expected gasoline and jet fuel demand, with more cars running on streets and people traveling by plane. Still, the country's refinery production is outpacing its consumption of the fuel, with exports currently at the highest rate this year, according to Kpler data compiled by Bloomberg. That's weighing on global gasoline prices. Meanwhile, global jet fuel demand is widely expected to approach pre-pandemic levels this year. But jet fuel is a relatively small cut of the oil barrel. Only around 10% of crude is turned into jet fuel in the U.S., compared to around 60% for gasoline. This means that even if jet fuel fully recovers, it won't be able to make up for losses from diesel and gasoline. This article is entitled, "Biden's Oil Reserve Withdrawals Spark Demand for Audit," by Ari Natter, Bloomberg. Top Republicans want a government watchdog to investigate the Biden administration's management of the nation's emergency oil reserves, arguing no credible plan exists to refill the cash that now stands at a 40-year low. In a letter sent Monday to the Government Accountability Office, GOP lawmakers demanded a wide-ranging audit that would examine whether the Biden administration's historic release of oil from the cache following Russia's invasion of Ukraine damaged the subterranean storage system. They also want details on a now-paused plan to modernize the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Mismanagement of the SPR has undermined America's energy security, leaving the nation more vulnerable to energy supply disruptions and increasing the ability for OPEC and Russia to use energy as a geopolitical weapon, wrote Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and Senator John Barrasso, the top Republican on the Energy Committee. The SPR, created to shield the country from supply disruptions after the 1970s-era Arab oil embargo, currently holds 365 million barrels, about half its total capacity. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm has said the department plans to refill the reserve to pre-war levels. This article is entitled, "DA, Man Sentenced to 40 Years for Injury to a Child," by Mercedes Cordero. A 40-year-old man was sentenced Friday to 40 years in prison for injury to a child, according to the Midland County District Attorney's Office. Juan Pedro Tejas, who was charged with injury to a child, a first-degree felony, negotiated the plea with the state that included waiving all rights to appeal, according to the press release. On October 12, 2020, Tejas was alone with his three-month-old child when he called his wife panicked because something was wrong with the baby, according to the press release. The toddler had a brain bleed and injuries to the neck consistent with non-accidental trauma and shaken baby, according to hospital staff in Midland and Lubbock. The DA's office reported that the toddler is now in a persistent vegetative state and requires 24-hour skilled nursing care. Tejas will not be eligible for parole until he serves 20 years of his term. Eligibility for parole does not guarantee that parole will be granted. This article is entitled, Mayor Blong. Hotel project not a done deal. By Stuart Doreen. Mayor Lori Blong said a proposal to build a $125 million to $140 million full-service hotel west of Centennial Park is still being negotiated and should not be considered a done deal. An item comes before the Midland City Council on Tuesday that calls for negotiations with a developer on a hotel project to fill downtown space, including land where the former Western United Life building once stood. Midland Downtown Renaissance LP, MDR, was the selected proposal based on the scoring criteria. The project to be built is a 135-key, high-quality hotel and parking on adjacent land to the proposal property in downtown Midland. Midland Downtown Renaissance LP is a collaborative effort by leading Midland-based companies, private investors, and Franklin Mountain Investments, one of the largest building owners downtown. Franklin Mountain's investment in downtown already was one thing that Midland Development Corporation Board Chairman Chase Gardoff and Blong said make this deal different than other attempts to put a signature hotel in downtown Midland. Franklin Mountain investment properties include the Bank of America Building, One Wall Plaza, First Capital Building, De Niro Plaza, and Atrium Center. Blong, Gardoff, and Midland Development Corporation Executive Director Sarah Harris mentioned Franklin Mountain has already been a part of the downtown revitalization effort in El Paso. The three also stated the involvement of the Scarborough Foundation of Midland is another factor that makes this Santa Rita project different. I think just with the RFP and the group that's doing it, and the excitement and the things that it can do to really change downtown, Gardoff said, we're looking forward to seeing it to the finish line, because I know we've had hiccups in the past. MDR, in its proposal, stated that public support will be needed, including, but not limited to, the following forms. 100% hotel occupancy tax, HOT, rebates, over a long period. Rebate of the city's portion of sales tax over a long period. Rebate of the city's portion of property tax over a long period. Conveyance of a shovel-ready site for the surface parking lot, structured parking garage in Phase 2, at no cost. Waiving of all city permit fees for construction. Substantial cash incentive payments during the construction and opening periods to cover any remaining construction cost deficits, which could range from $15 million to $30 million, excluding Phase 2. Grants, rebates, and incentives similar to those above for Phase 2, the structured parking garage, at such time as Phase 2 makes economic sense. MDR will also pursue any federal, state, and county incentive programs that may be available to assist with the project and the city. I would not be ready to commit to all of those things, Blong said, emphasizing negotiations still have to take place. Council approval on Tuesday would authorize the interim city manager and the Midland Development Corporation chairman to negotiate an agreement for the purpose of carrying out the intent of the proposal. The City of Midland and MDC will negotiate an agreement that will include a term, obligations, deal points, incentives, and a timeline. The agreement shall not become effective until approved by the Midland City Council. MDR anticipates construction to begin in 2024, with completion anticipated for late 2025 or early 2026. Development details. 8,000 square feet, 4 separate meeting rooms, 500 to 5,000 square feet each, 4,000 square feet three-meal restaurant and bar, approximately 185 seats. Lobby bar, market cafe featuring coffee, snacks, beverages, and sundries. Resort pool, room service, concierge service, retail locations. Hotel room information, 135 rooms. King rooms, 85,350 square feet. Queen rooms, 30,350 square feet. Sundries, 1,400 square feet. Entities involved. Midland Downtown Renaissance, LP, MDR, is a collaborative effort by leading Midland-based companies and private investors and Franklin Mountain Investments. Those entities include Franklin Mountain Investments, Scarborough Foundation, Headlock Investment Company, OGX Minerals, Roundtree Design, Jordan Foster Construction, Overland, HHM. Source, City of Midland. This article is entitled Midland High Wins UIL One Act Play State Championship by Stuart Doreen. The Midland High Theater team has captured the University Interscholastic League's One Act Play Class 6A State Championship. The meet was held this weekend and included 12 schools from around the state. Midland High went through district by district and area rounds to advance to the state meet. The state championship is the first for a Midland ISD school and the first for a West Texas school in the UIL's highest classification. One Act Play became a UIL competition for larger UIL schools during the 2003-2004 school year, according to the UIL website. I'm so proud of them, Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard said of the MHS team. I was in Round Rock, and their performance was amazing. To win the UIL 6A one-act play competition is such an accomplishment. The Midland High team used material from the play The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane. Finishing second and third were Bridgeland and Wolfforth Friendship, respectively. The UIL also reported that Midland High's Alex Gonzalez was named an All-Star Cast member, and that Jade Long was named an Honorable Mention All-Star Cast member. The trip to state was the third for Midland High Theater. One Act Play, The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane. State Championship Cast: Jade Lang, Charlotte Browder, Valeria Guillen, Alex Gonzalez, Aaron Velasquez, Jet Wood, Ryan Perez-Aneda, Collins Smith, Madison Coleman, Landry Wood, Zaniel Watts, Brianna Rivera, Mekki McCoy, Jacob Sinclair, Blaine Wheelis, Lila Horner, Colton Wilson, Daniel Salinas Reyes. State Championship Crew: Marissa Barones, Bethany Payan. State Championship Directors: Tiffany Gardner Moore, Rodrigo Sanchez, Logan Holmes. Results: Champion, Midland High. First runner up, Bridgeland. Second runner up, Wolfforth Friendship. All-Star Cast Member, Alex Gonzalez. Honorable Mention All-Star Cast Member, Jade Lang. Source: University Interscholastic League. This article is entitled MISD Reacts to School Bonds Passed by Stuart Doreen. Voters in area towns had no problem passing school bonds this past weekend. Andrews, Pecos Barstow Toya, Cahoma, Wink Loving, and Crane ISDs all posted bond victories on Saturday. Their combined bond totals surpassed $740 million, which coincidentally would be less than what early estimates show that it would cost to build two new Class 6A high schools in Midland. Still, a 5-0 run shows a willingness to improve facilities, unlike recent bond elections in Midland, Greenwood, and Odessa. Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard, when asked about the electoral successes around the region, congratulated our neighboring school districts and those around the state as they passed bond elections to address facility and infrastructure needs. As we continue the important work of the Bond Planning Committee, it has become even more evident the critical need to address our school facilities here in Midland. We are focused on all aspects of academic improvement, and we recognize that this is a process, Howard wrote. We are working to evaluate and improve our campus grade configurations, and we need to address our overcrowded and aging high schools and middle schools. Campus safety and security is also a top priority, and we are evaluating district-wide upgrades in this area as well. Around the region, school districts use multiple propositions in their respective electoral efforts. Between the five districts posting wins, 11 propositions were put on ballots, giving voters the ability to vote for or against different items as they saw fit. All 11 propositions passed by an average of 68% of the vote. In terms of what a future bond program could look like, I think it's too early to speculate on whether the bond would include one proposition or multiple propositions, Howard said about a Midland ISD school bond. It is important to point out that even if we held a bond election for this November 2023, the high schools would not be completed and ready to open until 2028. The longer we continue to delay addressing our facilities, the more we will pay due to inflation and rising construction costs. Interestingly, the school district that passed the largest bond was Pecos Toya Barstow ISD, which is impacted even more than Midland ISD in terms of recapture, the practice of sending money to the state to distribute to poorer school districts. In fact, Pecos Toya Barstow ISD gives a much larger percentage of its budget to recapture than MISD, 61.9% in 2022 at Pecos Toya Barstow ISD compared to 35.1% in 2022-23 at Midland ISD. Pecos Toya Barstow ISD bond haul totaled more than $446 million, including $411.58 million for new or improved high school and middle school facilities. A different proposition passed that will provide money to build a new natatorium. Right now, there are two meetings of the Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee still on the calendar, for June 1st and June 20th. The Bond Planning Committee will continue their work in the coming weeks with the goal of making a recommendation to the board, Howard wrote. This is a huge responsibility, but it's also an exciting time for Midland. Unofficial results showed five area towns with victories in elections. Andrews ISD. Andrews ISD voters approved $156.7 million across propositions A, B, and C based on unofficial election results, according to the district. Andrews ISD reported Proposition A, which addressed renovations and additions to the main high school building at a cost of $108.82 million, was approved at a 71.7% passing rate. Proposition B addressed athletic upgrades at a cost of $35.835 million. Voters approved it at a rate of 56.3% passing. Proposition C, which addressed renovations to the Mustang Bowl Stadium, was approved at a 55.7% passing rate. Pecos-Barstow-Toya ISD. Voters passed three Pecos-Barstow-Toya ISD propositions totaling more than $446 million on Saturday. Proposition A called for $411.58 million. It includes money for facilities like Pecos High School and Crockett Middle School. Proposition B called for $34.27 million for a new natatorium, and Proposition C called for $800,000 for technology equipment. The items passed, garnering between 65.1% and 66% of the vote. Coahoma ISD. Coahoma ISD voters approved two measures totaling more than $12 million. Proposition A called for the issuance of $7.765 million for school facilities and new school buses. It passed, earning more than 70% of the vote. Proposition B called for the issuance of $4.5 million for an indoor multipurpose facility. It collected just less than 60% of the vote. Crane ISD. Crane ISD voters approved one proposition totaling $68 million. Proposition A included $41.5 million for a new middle school, $17 million for high school enhancements, and $7.5 million for career and technology education. It passed, collecting 70.8% of the vote. Wink-Loving ISD. Wink-Loving ISD voters approved two items totaling $60 million. Proposition A called for the issuance of $60 million for school facilities and new school buses. It collected around 85% of the vote. Proposition B called for the issuance of $5 million for the construction of teacher housing. It collected around 87% of the vote. This article is entitled MPD Probes Pedestrian Fatality in South Midland. 18th reported fatality inside Midland County this year. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Midland police reported a 43-year-old Midland man was killed while attempting to cross Florida Avenue early Sunday morning. Around 2 a.m., officers with the Midland Police Department and EMS personnel were dispatched to the 200 block of East Florida Avenue in reference to a crash with a pedestrian. EMS personnel arrived and found a pedestrian in the roadway deceased. Initial investigation by the Midland Police Department Traffic Unit discovered that the male was attempting to cross the roadway from the north side of the street to the south, MPD reported. He was not using the crosswalk and was struck by a vehicle traveling westbound. MPD identified the deceased male as Noe Robles. The investigation is still ongoing, according to police. The fatality is the 18th reported inside Midland County this year, according to Reporter-Telegram records. This article is entitled MPD Seeks Information on Fraud Suspects by Mercedes Cordero. The Midland Police Department is seeking information that will help identify two fraud suspects who used a stolen credit card to make purchases at El Rancho Boots. On January 7th, two men captured on surveillance footage entered El Rancho Boots located at 900 South Garfield Street, where they purchased more than $2,500 in merchandise. The suspects used a stolen credit card, according to Midland Crime Stoppers. If a person is the first to submit any information on the suspects and it leads to an arrest, he or she will be eligible for a cash reward. Call Midland Crime Stoppers at 694-TIPS or download the Crime Stoppers app, P3 Tips, and submit an anonymous mobile tip. No caller ID is ever used, and those providing information will remain anonymous. Reference MPD case number 230-417-030. This article is entitled "Occidental Begins Buffett Stock Buyback" by Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. Occidental Petroleum Corporation began buying back Berkshire Hathaway Inc.'s $10 billion of preferred stock 4 years after Warren Buffett's firm made the investment during the oil producer's takeover of Anadarko Petroleum Corporation. Occidental issued mandatory redemption notifications for $474 million of preferred stock at a price of 110% of liquidation value, plus dividends in March, Berkshire said in its quarterly report. Berkshire still has about $9.5 billion of preferred stock in the Houston-based company, it said. Separately, Buffett's firm owns a 24% stake in Occidental common stock and is the company's largest shareholder, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Berkshire is willing to buy more Occidental common stock, Buffett said at its shareholder meeting in Omaha this month. However, he ruled out buying the oil producer outright. Occidental had flagged its intent to begin redeeming Berkshire's preferred stock after record earnings in 2022 helped it repay billions of dollars of debt. This article is entitled "Structure Fire in North Midland Under Investigation" by Mercedes Cordero. The Midland Fire Department responded to a structure fire Monday morning in North Midland, according to a city spokesperson. The City of Midland reported that about 3:30 a.m., crews with the Midland Fire Department responded to a structure fire in the 6400 block of Wewoka Place. Only non-life-threatening injuries due to glass while evacuating the home were reported, the city reported. The cause of the fire is under investigation. The American Red Cross is assisting two displaced residents.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, May 9th, 2023. Section A. Assault Trial Underway in Odessa by Kim Smith. An Ector County jury that must decide the fate of a 39-year-old Odessa man accused of sexually assaulting an 11-year-old more than 4 years ago heard from the alleged victim Monday afternoon. Daniel Anthony Chavez is facing two counts of aggravated sexual assault of a child in the 161st Ector County District Court. After questioning her first witness, former Ector County Deputy Luke Smith, Assistant Ector County District Attorney Courtney Williams summoned the alleged victim. The soft-spoken girl spoke freely about her family, but when it came time to tell the jury about the alleged events, she spoke more haltingly. When questioned about that, the girl told Williams, "It's a memory I wouldn't like to remember." The now 15-year-old girl testified that on November 20th, 2018, she went to bed early, but woke up because her rabbit was out of water and making a lot of noise. When she got up to remove his water bottle, her younger sister took over the bottom bunk of the bed they shared, spreading out like a starfish. So she grabbed a blanket and moved to the floor, rather than risk making her sister grumpy. She was laying on her stomach in her Disney character-themed pajamas when she heard footsteps, she testified. Moments later, Chavez flipped her over onto her front. "He started messing with me. He pulled down my pants and he started playing with me," the girl testified. Under further questioning from Williams, the girl testified her underwear came off with her pajama bottoms. She then described Chavez digitally penetrating her and performing oral sex on her. She doesn't remember him saying anything at that point, but she remembers her mother entering the room, turning on the light, and asking Chavez what he was doing in the room. "He picked up the front of my pants and ran into the bathroom," the girl said, adding she remembers hearing the water running. Chavez told her mom he'd been getting ready to pick her up to put her back in the bed, she said. Her mother also asked Chavez why her PJ bottoms were down in the back, the girl testified. "My mom called the police and told him to get out," she said. At one point, her mom momentarily left the room, and Chavez begged her not to tell authorities what happened, the teenager testified. After a deputy came to her home, the girl testified she went to Medical Center Hospital and then the Harmony Home Children's Advocacy Center. During cross-examination from defense attorney Luis Chavez, the girl acknowledged she didn't tell anyone at the hospital or Harmony Home. Her mom had momentarily left the room, but she said it was because she wasn't asked. She also acknowledged there were times when she told a sexual assault nurse examiner and a forensic examiner she didn't remember certain things. Under redirect, the girl insisted no one told her what to say on the stand. In fact, she said she was just told to tell the truth. "What happened is not something she likes talking about," she said. "It's hard." Stephanie Schoen, a mental health director at Harmony Home with 25 years of experience treating sex offenders and sexual assault victims, took the stand immediately following the girl's testimony. She testified about the common techniques sex offenders use to identify and groom their victims and some of the ways people react to the trauma of being victimized. "The human brain often tries to disassociate from traumatic incidents, such as a protective measure, and thus it's common for people to say they don't remember events," she testified. She pointed out that when Williams presented the girl two photos of herself taken around the time of the alleged assault and asked her to identify the person in the photos, she replied in the third person. Under cross-examination from Chavez's other defense attorney, Anthony Chavez, Schoen testified victims of sex crimes can react to danger years later in one of two ways. They can disassociate and ignore all of the red flags, or they can become hypervigilant and spot red flags everywhere. Earlier, outside the presence of the jury, the girl had been asked if she, Chavez, and her mother had ever spoken about her mother having been abused in the past. The girl said no. During opening statements, Luis Chavez told jurors there is no DNA or other tangible evidence an assault took place. He asked them to keep an open mind. The trial will resume at 9 a.m. Tuesday. Judge Justin Lowe is presiding. Sardui to highlight Banquet of Hope Entertainment. Growing up, stand-up comedian Jose Sardui originally aspired to be an astronaut. But as he mentioned in his phone interview, you have to fail your way into comedy. "Being an astronaut was my goal as a kid," he said, "but I failed enough times as a kid that it didn't look good." Safe to say, everything's worked out well for the Cuban-born comedian. Sardui will make his return to the Permian Basin Saturday at the Catholic Charities of Odessa's annual Banquet of Hope fundraiser. The event will take place at 7 p.m., at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center in the Permian Ballroom. This year's Banquet of Hope will return to an in-person setting for the first time since 2019, before the pandemic hit. hit. Myself, the staff, the board were all super excited. Executive Director of Catholic Charities of Odessa, Sarah Aguilar, said, "We were very fortunate to have our fundraiser that year. We're excited to have this coming up. It's also going to be the first time the fundraiser will consist of stand-up comedy, in which Aguilar says will be family-friendly. Before, it was just a banquet with a showcase on the programs and then a dinner," Aguilar said. "This is the first time we're adding entertainment to our event." Born in Cuba, Sardui had a roller coaster of a life growing up. He, along with his family, was deported from Cuba in 1980 because of his father's political prisoner status. Sardui's father served 6 years in prison in Cuba for writing a letter that disagreed with then-Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, his regime, and its policies. "When he got out, I was born shortly after," Sardui said. "He couldn't get a job, and my mom got fired. My family eventually got blacklisted for everything." His family was eventually forced out of Cuba and came to the United States during the Mirai boat lift in 1980. After graduating from high school, Sardui was accepted into the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado. Being a trainer pilot in the Air Force, Sardui made numerous flights to Del Rio as well as Odessa and Midland. "I have lived in Texas before, being stationed there, so it always has a special place in my heart. Odessa is a blue-collar community. I always liked the audience there. It's great to come back and see how the town has grown since the last time I was there in 2017 or 2018. During the pandemic, we did a lot of trips to Midland for training since I was on long duty, so it'll be nice to leave the airport in Midland and go to Odessa, especially since I've done a lot in Midland. I get to fill up my Odessa tank." Despite being a retired Air Force veteran, Sardui still trains pilots in Del Rio as a reserve in addition to his stand-up career. After being accepted into the U.S. Air Force Academy, Sardui's goal was to be a mission pilot in the Space Shuttle program in the early 2000s. But those plans got trampled after NASA made the announcement to discontinue the shuttle program. That meant that if I wanted to be an astronaut, I was going to have to compete academically with the other astronauts, he said. Sardui would still become an officer in the Air Force, serving in Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom in the early 2000s, flying cargo planes. "It was a fun experience, but I didn't have a gun on my plane, which is scary. In that situation, it had been nice to have one." While he has enjoyed his time with the military, he didn't want it to be full-time. "I was kind of lost a little bit," Sardui said. "My childhood passion was dying a little bit. I had a good life. I was an Air Force pilot and had a good life set up, but the passion was gone." In came his other childhood passion, comedy. "I grew up loving it," Sardui said. "The power of comedy made an impression on me. The funniest teachers were always the most effective, and humor can be used to diffuse tension and help you get through tough times." He didn't originally think he would be doing stand-up comedy, though, as he doubted whether or not he could make a room full of people laugh. "I loved to do stand-up," Sardui said, "but I wasn't very funny. I was an inside joke teller, so I never saw myself as a joke teller." Then, in 2003, while on a trip to Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, something clicked for him. He was with his girlfriend and her friends, and he started telling stories about himself. "Maybe it was the right amount of beer, but they wanted to hear more about me and my life," Sardui said. "It was about 10 minutes where it was just me talking, and everyone was laughing hard. One of the women fell out of her chair, and another shot beer out of his nose. I don't remember what I said. That's when I really started looking at being a stand-up comedian and realized what it took." Over the years, Sardoui worked his way up, eventually doing an open mic at the New York Comedy Club. I got one legitimate chuckle from the hardened comedians who were there, and that was it, Sardoui said. I was in. It's been an interesting ride since then. Since 2007, Sardoui has been doing stand-up comedy full-time, traveling all over the country, doing different shows. He talks to audiences about his life experiences, including the funny everyday moments from growing up with his family. Just like Aguilar, Sardoui insists that next week's entertainment will be suitable for families. It's a charity event, so they'll get my clean comedy, Sardoui said. I know some people who are in the area who have seen me before are probably thinking this might not be appropriate for a charity, but I'm telling people that I've been doing comedy for a long time. I can do clean comedy. I have a couple of comedy specials under the belt. People can relax. It's going to be a fun show. These are jokes that are about my life and all that. But you can bring the kids. This year, Catholic Charities of Odessa is celebrating its 40th anniversary of helping the community. It's a big one for us to be able to be here and serve all of those in Ector County, Aguilar said. This has been a staple fundraiser over the years, so it's just keeping on with the tradition. When Catholic Charities of Odessa opened in 1982, it was originally an adoption agency. They ran that for 3 years, Aguilar said. Several children were adopted through Catholic Charities during those 3 years. Soon after, the organization switched over to social services, providing the emergency services for food and clothing in the community. That's what they've grown into ever since, Aguilar said. I know our learning center is really busy. We see on average about 450 students every year who successfully complete courses through the learning center. So we're very busy. The agency continues to grow. The work hasn't stopped, especially with a pandemic and high inflation affecting a number of people with families who are in need of help. During COVID, we were hit really hard, Aguilar said. We never shut our doors to the community, and our numbers soared through the roof. We were seeing triple, if not quadruple, the numbers for emergency services, especially for the food pantry. There were a lot of people out of work. Those numbers are starting to rise again due to inflation, Aguilar said. This fundraiser has come at a crucial time because we need that help from the community to continue to serve those who are in need. For more information on Catholic Charities of Odessa, go to tinyurl.com/YC7WDZA6. Tickets for the banquet can be purchased at tinyurl.com/YCKJCYBN. If you go, Catholic Charities of Odessa's Banquet of Hope, 7 p.m. June 11th at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center. Artists hard at work for Mural Fest. Recognize this face? The Permian Basin's own Eric Baker is being immortalized by Hugh Murals in the Odessa Loves Jazz mural at Copper Key Realty on 5th and Grant. Odessa Arts Mural Fest is this weekend, and three of the four muralists are already hard at work in downtown Odessa, gearing up for the big reveal Saturday, May 13th. Selected muralists include Nakoda Witskin, Dan Thompson, Maxalie Martel, and Jeremy Flores. Muralists were encouraged to create designs that celebrate Odessa's designation as a music-friendly community by Governor Greg Abbott in 2022. Another great attraction to see are the painted pianos. Designed and created by Permian Basin artists, these pianos will grace the festival, and playing on them is encouraged. Traffic boxes. Thanks to their partners at Vital Signs and Downtown Odessa Incorporated, all of the traffic boxes in downtown now boast artwork from local talent. Check them out on your daily commute. Preview party. Get a sneak peek at Mural Fest at the special preview party at Homemade Wines from 7 to 10 p.m. Friday, May 12th. Enjoy great food and wine, and get up close with the Bike Zoo and Paradox Traveling Art. Meet the muralists and musicians. Limited number of tickets, so get yours now. An Evening with Barry Corbin. There is still time to get your tickets for An Evening with Barry Corbin at the Ector Theater at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, May 13th. Want to volunteer? Head over to the Mural Fest website and sign up.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.